guys, it's your girl Ginger, the true crime queen. I'm reminding you now that listener discretion is advised. The dark nature of this show is not suitable for young ears or those that are sensitive to graphic material. But without further ado, let's get it. Well, hi there, you guys. Welcome back. I know I've been gone for a while, but I decided to come out of my weird little hiatus thing to tell you about a case that's become really, really important to me. It might possibly be the most important case I have covered yet, and I'm sincerely hoping that by telling this story today and more people learning about it, hopefully other big podcasts will start telling the story, and ideally, we could get some justice for Jordan Marie Sims and her family. This episode's case is honestly pretty triggering, especially for anyone in the Me Too movement, as we're going to be discussing multiple instances of sexual assault allegations that unfortunately involve both men and women who had previously taken an oath to serve and protect. So this is a pretty upsetting case all around, to be honest. I do urge you, though, to stay with me through the whole episode. It's really important that Jordan's story be understood, and she deserves the truth to be told. So, let's get right freaking to it. The abso-freaking-lutely beautiful Jordan Marie Sims was born on October 8th of 1991 at the Mount Graham Hospital in Safford, Arizona. She weighed a perfect 7 pounds and 5 ounces, and she was said to have grown to be a very mellow and sweet little baby. And thank God, too, because Jordan's mom, Deborah, was hella going through it in the middle of a divorce just like 6 months after little Jordy was born. And Deborah didn't just have Jordan, she was also raising a toddler, Jordan's older sister, Ashley. You can imagine how stressful a divorce with two babies probably is. After the divorce, though, Deborah had to move the girls all around southeast Arizona for work during their younger years, but did thankfully get some extra time to help coach Jordan for her elementary school's soccer team. As a child, Jordan was described as normally quiet and somewhat shy, like around strangers, but to her family, she was the jokester. She pulled all the pranks, she was goofy, she would be the one to pop out and scare you, she would be the one to have you just busting up. And Jordan was also described as having just one of those contagious laughs that keep everyone rolling after it starts. Her older sister Ashley was actually telling me about this one time when they were both lucky enough to be pregnant around the same time. And goofing around together one day, Jordan actually did a belly flop right onto her mom's couch ottoman because she like literally spaced out that she was pregnant. And no worries, the baby was completely fine. But it just had Jordan and Ashley rolling until their sides ached because Jordan couldn't believe she just did that. And I don't know this family, yet I can picture this entire scenario with one of my own best friends, honestly. If you know me, you know that I did not look pregnant until I was like literally about to give birth. Back to their childhood, though. The girl's mom, Deborah, did end up getting together with a former high school boyfriend and eventually got married to him. This man went as far as adopting both Jordan and Ashley as his own, which sounds great, but he also ended up being incredibly abusive to their mother, Deborah, which is not easy to live with or see when you're growing up, I'm sure. Deborah was eventually able to leave this relationship, thankfully, and ended up going back to work full-time when the girls hit about middle school age and they could start staying at home alone. At one point, big sister Ashley actually started taking initiative and would begin making those, like, banquet home-style bake meal kits. If you remember them from, like, the early 2000s, it was in a big red box. And you could, like, the whole kit was there and you could just make dinner in one box. It was kind of neat. Anyways, Ashley started making dinner for Jordan and their mom, Deborah, so she wouldn't have to make dinner after a long day of work. Which is honestly like the sweetest thing I've ever heard. Like, I wish I would have had the presence of mind or been that thoughtful to my own hardworking single mom, honestly. Girl, you're shitting all over me. A little later down the road, Deborah found herself in another relationship, also pretty abusive, but this time, unfortunately, the abuse had tragically extended down to Jordan, and I'm not talking physical abuse, we're talking sexual abuse, which is sadly something that her own mom didn't even find out until after a divorce and years down the road. So sadly, we know now that Jordan was incurring all that trauma pretty much alone. And Jordan attended high school in Morenci, Arizona, and at one point she had even expressed interest in going into law enforcement as a possible career choice in her future, which makes this story just the tiniest bit more sad when you think about it. But instead of law enforcement, Jordan was given the amazing opportunity to be a mother, just at the young age of 18. Which thankfully, her own loving mother, Deborah, was more than willing to help support and love and accept this grandbaby into their lives. Jordan did end up dropping out of high school and later attempted to get her GED, though eventually began running into some health problems not long after giving birth to her first baby girl. Jordan ended up being diagnosed with both rheumatoid arthritis, which is an autoimmune disease that causes joint pain and damage throughout your entire body, as well as a second autoimmune disease known as lupus, which is where your body's immune system attacks its own tissues and organs. So she's fighting like two uphill battles there. And she was diagnosed with both of these at a pretty young age. I think it was 23. And by the birth of her second child, Jordan's doctors decided to put her onto oxycodone for her pain management. Being that oxy is extremely addictive, her mom Deborah obviously became worried about Jordan being prescribed oxy, though she was assured by Jordan's doctor that there was no need to worry as Jordan was only being issued a low dose of oxycodone. And I believe this did work for Jordan's pain for a while. However, after Jordan's third baby was born, the oxy was no longer working for her, and she inevitably started using the next stronger thing, heroin, which definitely put her mother, Deborah, in a very uncomfortable position as a grandma. Keep in mind, I think Jordan had three kids in a matter of 6 years, which is alone pretty tough on a woman's body, I can testify to that. But to add rheumatoid arthritis, lupus, and an accelerating opiate tolerance slash addiction, all while trying to be a good mom, like, oh my God. Her mom, Deborah, explained to me too that the use of alcohol for Jordan was actually more of a rarity because alcohol would tend to trigger something in Jordan's past abuse and spike her depression really bad. So she really avoided alcohol for the most part. Except for this one time, though, when Ashley told me that her and Jordan were hanging out by the pool one day and Ashley had made mudslides, which Jordan had never tried before. So when she tried it, she ended up liking it so much that she stole the whole blender and wouldn't share anymore with Ashley. And they spent the day together sliding on the slip and slide, which is an awesome memory. I feel like everybody needed to know right there. Anyway, but as far as her actual addictions went, Jordan would also personally go through many attempts at detoxing off the pain meds and opiates, but more often than not, she would fall back into her addictions, whether it was intolerable pain, the untreated depression, the trauma, or the stress of simply being back and forth between an addiction. It is not easy to beat an addiction by yourself. I read that the Recovery Research Institute found that the average number of serious attempts at recovery are about five attempts before sobriety usually occurs. Jordan's mom explains that she dealt with a lot of her own demons. She was just looking to make herself happy and was looking in the wrong direction. She was a wonderful mom. She made some bad decisions, but she was always good to her kids. About 2018, it was decided that for Jordan's children's best interests, that all three of them be technically placed into their grandmother Deborah's care with something known as a kinship placement, while Jordan sorted out her health and her addiction issues away from the family in a hotel. During this time, though, while Jordan is in the hotel, she called her mom Deborah to bring her some food over to eat. Naturally, Deborah picked up the three kids, grabbed some food, brought it over to Jordan. And apparently the courts did not want Jordan interacting with her children at all during this kinship placement, and because Deborah had brought them to the hotel where Jordan was located, the courts then relocated Jordan's three children over to Deborah's mother's care, who would technically be these children's great-grandmother. And from what I understand at this point, which I believe is about early 2019, Jordan returns home to her mother Deborah's and begins trying to turn her life around, this time for good though. She wanted her kids back, she wanted off the drugs, she was serious about getting back on track and making a sincere effort and promise to get clean. Though Jordan's time ran out faster than anyone could have ever anticipated. Jordan's last days began on Saturday, December 21st of 2019, when she was making her weekly run to the Safford area Walmart for the second sweetest thing I'd ever heard of. She was getting two little cartons of Ben & Jerry's ice cream, one for her and one for her dog, Dez. Her mom tells me that Jordan would always sit and eat ice cream with her dog, which is adorable, but actually found the receipt from this day in Jordan's belongings later down the road. Ironically, Jordan's mom was also at the same Walmart this day and happened to notice a couple of cop cars there, but never thought it would have something to do with her daughter, Jordan. Apparently, while Jordan was there at Walmart, they had suspected her of previously shoplifting and had notified the police that she was at the store. This is when Safford police officer Jeremiah French is apparently dispatched over to Walmart, where Jordan was then somehow confronted for the supposed shoplifting. No items were obviously found to have been stolen during this incident, but in the process of running her name, Officer French was then informed of a warrant for Jordan's arrest out of the neighboring county of Yavapai, which means he's going to have to take her in anyways. This warrant had stemmed from a previous incident the year prior, when Jordan had apparently used her father's car, but it ended up technically being her father's girlfriend's car, so it had been reported stolen. And police later found a bag of heroin in the car while Jordan had it in her possession. I believe when she did not show up to a court hearing for those charges, a warrant was then issued for her arrest, but it basically went unacknowledged, being that it was not in the same county that Jordan was actually living in. And she apparently hadn't got into any problems with the police since that incident, so her past had sort of caught up to her really unexpectedly on this day. So imagine, it's the Saturday before Christmas. One minute you're at Walmart buying some Chunky Monkey, maybe a little Cherry Garcia for your mo-fucking dog. And the next thing you know, Walmart is calling the popo and now you're being handcuffed and told that you're going to jail and you'll have to wait for transportation to the next county over. Yeah, great. I'm absolutely sure that's what Jordan had planned this day. Yeah. According to this arresting officer, this is when Jordan mentions to him that she had recently been having some stomach pains and could possibly even be pregnant and would like to be evaluated at the hospital before going into the detention facility. Even though officers probably hear this sort of excuse all the time and likely did not believe what Jordan was saying, Officer French did call for an ambulance to transport Jordan over to the nearby Mount Graham Regional Medical Center for pregnancy testing, while Officer French apparently followed behind in his own patrol vehicle. Okay, so here's your trigger warning for sexual assault because it's unfortunately about to get very uncomfortable from here on out. While Jordan is at this Mount Graham Regional Medical Center there in Safford, Arizona, she speaks with medical staff about her pain and pregnancy concerns, but actually refuses all medications offered, being that she is legit trying to stay away from pain pills or anything of the sort. But she does submit to a pregnancy test, possibly a couple other tests as well. While waiting for the results of these tests and during a 15 to 30 minute time period alone together, Officer Jeremiah French starts coming on to Jordan. According to her mom, this was not the first time Jordan and Jeremiah had interacted, and apparently even her friends had witnessed him propositioning her in the past. Jordan isn't interested in Officer French, though, but regardless, he begins scooting closer to her, then apparently has the audacity to stick his disgusting, dirty hands up Jordan's shirt, then down her pants, and all up into her goodies. All while she's in police handcuffs and completely non-consensual. And wouldn't you know it, naturally, when this is all happening to Jordan, of course, the officer's body cam just so conveniently happens to be turned off because, according to his police report, he, quote, didn't want to violate any HIPAA laws within the hospital, end quote. Ladies and gentlemen, this is exactly fucking why police body cams exist. From a predator's perspective, this would be the best time to victimize someone in Jordan's position. She's alone, with a person of authority. She's vulnerable, and there is nothing in this situation to disprove her claims. She obviously has a bit of criminal history, and that never gives anyone any credibility. And unfortunately, because of the lack of body camera footage, the only evidence to prove anything did or didn't happen would have to be DNA of hers on his fingers, or possibly some skin cells he left inside her. Otherwise, it's sort of just his word against hers. Jordan clarified that this was technically only digital penetration within her vagina, to be graphically specific. And if you consider the officer's circumstances, all he would have to do was wash his hands or put on some hand sanitizer to ruin any possible evidence of her on him. But we can't forget that he also has no proof that this didn't happen because of the lack of body camera footage. It kind of works both ways, I guess. Again, if you can for 1 second imagine that you've just been surprise arrested for whatever frickin' reason, and now you've been absolutely violated by a police officer that has arrested you, and now you're being told and expected to get in the back of this asshole's police vehicle where you're even more vulnerable and confined with your abuser for transport to jail. Like, is that not one of everyone's worst nightmare scenarios, honestly? Man or woman? Like, who do you call if you're already with the fucking police, you know? If I was Jordan, I would also not want to be anywhere near this officer. However, it's not like you have much of a choice in the matter, and she's taken over to the Graham County Detention Center regardless, after her pregnancy test had returned with a negative. And honestly, this must have been a pretty triggering and desperate time for Jordan, as the next thing we know for sure is that she is seen running on jail security camera from Officer French while they are in the bay area of the detention center. While French is grabbing something from the inside of his vehicle, a handcuffed Jordan can be seen standing near, then suddenly making a run for it from eventually two officers just outside the Graham County Detention Center at 4:52 p.m. And the footage also seems to show us that Jordan doesn't look like she's wearing any pants for some reason. I suppose they could be, like, skin-colored pants, but something is weird about her outfit. I'm fairly sure she did not walk into Walmart that way. Anyways, Jordan is eventually tackled to the pavement. Ouch. Especially if she wasn't wearing pants, if you think about it. And she was walked back to the detention center, still wearing what seems to be only underwear, handcuffs, and just like a black and white checkered shirt from what the camera can show. I've saved all these links of the video footage that I'm referring to, and I'll put them in the episode description sources if you want to check them out for yourself. For whatever reason, Jordan's actual booking photo was then taken almost an entire 12 hours after we see her running in the bay. It was taken in the early morning hours of December 22nd at 3:55 a.m. It's like she must have sat in intake that whole time or something. And in return for her attempt to escape Officer French's custody upon their arrival to the jail, Jordan is now, finger quotes here, red tagged, and she's considered to be evasive and possibly suicidal. Apparently, throughout the chaos of it all and the struggle with Officer French, Jordan had mentioned at some point that she wanted to die. But then again, how would you feel if you felt this unsafe and helpless? So she's red tagged and she will be held in solitary confinement. Her clothes will be taken and she will only be given access to an anti-self-harming smock. It's like an anti-suicide smock and a blanket, all within a padded cell. She can be seen on jail security footage on the early morning of December 22nd wearing this suicide smock and covering herself with the blanket. December 23rd, 2 days after her arrest, would be the first time that Jordan is allowed to make a phone call. And she does so to her mother, Deborah, of course, who at that point hadn't seen Jordan for 3 days and was really worried she had relapsed. However, the sobering phone call from jail probably wasn't much more comforting, especially after what Jordan had to tell her. And being a mother, having to listen to your child at any age say that they were not only arrested the day before last, but that the arresting officer that you've had previous issues with had actually sexually assaulted you on top of it, is probably one of the worst things this mother could have heard. Jordan's mom, Deborah, didn't even want to believe what she was hearing, considering the depth of, like, fuckery of what that situation actually entails. But when she hears the way that Jordan is speaking to her, a good mom can hear the truth in your pain, and she did. It's almost evident in the way that Jordan can be seen on jailhouse recording, practically begging her mom to get her out of jail.
Mommy, please listen to me, I need you right now more than ever. So
Jordan is pleading her mother Deborah to bail her out of jail, feeling as though something worse is going to happen to her while she's there. Unfortunately, her bail hadn't yet been decided, and either way, bail isn't going to be an easy thing to afford, especially being so close to Christmas. In the meantime, Deborah urged her daughter to report the assault to the officers there at the jail at the very least. When Jordan is finally able to, she does officially report to the Graham County detention officers that she had been sexually assaulted by the arresting officer, Jeremiah French, prior to her arriving at the jail. When Jordan made this report too, she included that this hospital assault was the main reason that she had attempted to flee Officer French in the Bay Area of the detention center, because she said she had been, quote, traumatized from previous sexual assaults from when she was younger, which caused a fight or flight moment for her to run for the gates to get away from Officer French, end quote. The very next day, December 24th of 2019, Safford Police Department had placed Officer French on administrative leave pending an investigation into Jordan's claims, which is typically per their policy. According to the police report that Officer French made in regards to Jordan's arrest, he noted that Jordan had, quote, continuously told me sorry and that she was scared of going to Yavapai County, end quote. But mentions nothing really about the hospital visit except that they met with staff and found that Jordan wasn't pregnant. His police report, interestingly, does, though, confirm that Jordan did, in fact, refuse all medications that she was offered there while at the hospital. So after reporting that she had been sexually assaulted while in custody of the arresting officer, Jordan would then be transported to a facility known as Lori's Place Advocacy Center to speak with a sexual assault nurse examiner and have a specialized exam done, which is basically a rape kit that hopefully finds evidence supporting her claims. This Lori's Place facility, though, is actually all the way in Sierra Vista, which, according to Google, is about a two-hour drive away from Safford. I'm not sure why this center was chosen and not the much closer hospital, but it's possible that this facility is contracted with the detention center in some way, which I don't like the sounds of that either, but again, I'm really not sure why this particular facility is chosen. Also, this place has now renamed itself to the Cochise Family Advocacy Center, and I might have butchered that name, but I think it's the same business, basically. Keep in mind for this rape kit, though, it had technically already been 2 days since the assault with Officer French had occurred, and DNA doesn't just really hang around in vaginas forever because they're self-cleaning, if you didn't know, or you just, you know, don't have one. And with this scenario really being only a matter of skin cells and not something like sperm, it's possible there isn't really much DNA left inside Jordan after 2 days to test for. Whatever the results will be, though, are said to be sent back over to the Safford Police Department for their own internal investigation. However, it seems like Jordan's interview with the nurse examiner at this place was video recorded on a police body cam, and it was also kept for police records. And in that video, Jordan can be heard speaking about the assault with Officer French and why she ran away from him. Jordan explained that she instinctively ran away from Officer French, who assaulted her, and it ended up appearing as though she was trying to escape custody rather than just his specific custody.
Okay, don't care. Everything's gonna be okay. Everything's gonna be okay. So just don't make me look stupid. He starts just rubbing on my body on top of my clothes, and then he moves his hand down farther in my pants, and then he starts, I don't want to talk about this no more.
You can also see on video how Jordan explained that the officers at the jail then put her on suicide watch, forcing her to be in a padded cell without clothes and only a anti-self-harming suit, which is obviously not really helping her feel any less violated. When asked by the sexual assault examiner why officers would think she was suicidal, to which Jordan said she wanted to die. Then Jordan asked if she had exhibited any suicidal tendencies before, and Jordan also said, yes, when I was little and I was molested. Which, I'm not a psychologist or a therapist of any sort, obviously, but that doesn't sound like out of the realm of possibilities to me. When someone is traumatically abused, I can understand the fight or flight response that would be associated with similar incidents of abuse. Imagine being in between a rock and a hard place of getting assaulted by the same people who are supposed to call for help. I honestly think I would also try to run, and I would also feel like dying if I couldn't run. And yeah, basically, I can't even imagine the mental place that Jordan had to have been in during her last few days alive. After speaking with nurses at Lori's place, Jordan wouldn't make it back to the detention center until about 2:30 in the morning on Christmas Eve, December 24th. She can then be seen on jail security camera at 2:56 a.m. being escorted from the booking area down the hall to what's called the shower room by a female detention officer known as Kiana Bays. She will be checking Jordan for any contraband before re-entering her cell. Weirdly, I just noticed that in this security footage clip, Jordan is only wearing one orange-colored jail-issued sandal for some reason. I wonder what the hell that's about. It was while in this shower room, though, for what the security camera reads as 2 minutes, when Jordan is being told to squat and cough twice, and while facing away from the female officer, Jordan claims this is when she is assaulted now for the second time, when this Kiana Bays had literally shoved something straight into Jordan's butt, possibly a pen, all within this 2 minute body search inside the shower room. Jordan later explains that when this happened to her, she then tried to turn around and like away from this woman, but claims that Officer Kiana Bays then just shoved Jordan's head and face into the metal bar there that's on the wall in front of her, while saying to Jordan, "Now you know what it really feels like to be assaulted, and who's really going to believe you because you already cried wolf about what French did."
Why don't you go and report this? Who's gonna believe you now?
Yeah. According to the same security camera located outside this shower room, Jordan was then apparently left in the shower room alone for a few seconds while detention officer Bays seems to have retrieved a roll of toilet paper just outside the shower room and then returned to the shower room with Jordan where there are no more cameras. Footage does not show anything, obviously, in the detention officer's hands, but additional footage has been revealed to show this officer later handing what looks possibly like a pen to another nearby officer in exchange for the toilet paper just after her interaction with Jordan. Jordan was presumably then taken to her padded cell just after this second assault occurred, and it wouldn't be until almost 8 p.m., which was about 17 hours later, that we can see Jordan reporting this second assault by this female officer. The jail, though, seemed to be more interested in having Jordan extradited over to the county that had originally issued her arrest warrant, so it seems as though Jordan might have actually had to report this to several officers before it was officially documented by one of the sheriff's deputies. In that report, Jordan admits that at the time, she's not sure what the object was that had penetrated her, and also didn't know the name of the officer, but only that she was female. Which, again, probably just made several officers roll their eyes at her, and unfortunately for Jordan, with it literally being the eve of Christmas Day, I would be willing to bet that most of those officers had other priorities on their minds, sadly.
She took me back into the shower room to dress me out, and she shut the door. She had me undress and bend over to cough. And when I bent over to cough, I felt something go up my rectum.
Okay.
And she said, "This is what it feels like to really be sexually assaulted." And then she tells me that who's gonna blame me because I already just cried wolf about what French did me.
Okay.
That's why I wasn't gonna report it, because I didn't want anyone to think I was stupid.
However, Jordan is apparently noting that whatever she was sodomized with had actually caused her to start bleeding, and now she's requesting to have another sexual assault evaluation done, but she's going to have to wait until after Christmas, apparently. And sadly, Christmas was Jordan's absolute favorite holiday, which she was forced to spend in jail, but thankfully she did get to speak with her mother, Deborah, one last time. I believe they also arranged for a scheduled visit the next day, December 26th.
I love you. I love you very much.
I love you,
Jordan. I love you very much. You're beautiful. You're amazing. You're the best mom anyone can ever ask for. And I know what I've done to you is wrong in so many ways. Because you're better than that, and so am I. I need you, so please don't give up. Having these phone calls, Mom, is the only thing that's keeping me going right now. Knowing that whenever I'm going to call, you're going to be right there to answer.
But before this visit could occur, Jordan is seen on security camera being escorted to a transport vehicle in the Facility Bay Area for presumably her second exam over at the advocacy center called Lori's Place in Sierra Vista, which again was a whole ass 1 hour and 55 minutes away. Back at the Graham County Detention Facility, though, Jordan's mom, Deborah, is arriving for her and Jordan's scheduled visit. However, she was instead approached by a group of three large sheriff's deputies, who then informed her that Jordan is no longer located at their jail, and they would also not be able to disclose Jordan's current whereabouts, basically telling Deborah to kick rocks. So this is when Deborah instinctively realizes, no, something's up. She knew about Jordan's accusations against the officers and did not like how it took three officers to inform her that Jordan wasn't available for their visit. But basically, Deborah would just have to go back home and wait for a call from Jordan to set up another visit because there's literally nothing else she can do. Back with Jordan, who's on her way to be re-examined for the second sexual assault claim, and another rape kit would be taken. Jordan would also be interviewed by the same exact nurse who spoke with her when she visited for the first assault 3 days earlier on December 23rd. Again, this time, Jordan can also be seen on an officer's body cam speaking to the nurse, so apparently these officers don't care about any HIPAA violations. The camera itself reads that it's 3:29 p.m. on December 26th, whereas their paperwork for this exam indicates that the start time was about 4:10, which is a good timeline for us to start with. Jordan can be seen explaining to the sexual assault examiner that when she was first returned back to the jail after their first exam together, she was then vindictively sodomized by a female detention officer who escorted Jordan to the shower room. As far as Jordan's actual physical exam of the alleged sodomy goes, the nurse examiner actually noted that there was additional bruising and a tear in Jordan's genital area that hadn't seemed to start healing yet from the previous assault, but noted that there was no evidence of any additional anal assault per this female detention officer. None of it was apparent. The report says, quote, "I didn't see any injury that was consistent with forcing an object into her rectum. There were no tears noticeable to me. If something was forcibly inserted into the rectum, there would be tears. I do not see any sign that would cause me to believe that she had been forcibly penetrated. I did notice possible new bruises on Sim's legs and a horizontal mark on her forehead." Which, to me, that seems to corroborate at least some of what Jordan is claiming then, honestly. But because Jordan's original bruising did seem worse than when she was previously seen, and Jordan was complaining of lower back and rectal pain, plus bleeding, this nurse examiner had recommended that Jordan be seen again back over at the hospital for additional testing. I believe a CT scan was requested on her lower back and pelvic area to make sure that nothing was actually inside of Jordan, given the context of her allegations. And from what I understand, too, this nurse actually recommended that Jordan be seen at the nearby hospital there in Sierra Vista, which would have been located just 11 minutes down the road from where they're at. But before going back to the jail, and for whatever reason, the two detention officers transporting Jordan decided to head back towards Safford to the Mount Graham Regional Medical Facility, where Jordan had been assaulted the first time with arresting officer French. Yeah, sure, let's just further traumatize this girl more. Okay, yeah, sure, let's just put this girl on another two-hour trip back home, further traumatizing her. Yeah. But while en route to the hospital for those additional tests, though, it's almost like a phenomenon happened. And this is going to be really hard to believe. But at 6:42 p.m., about two blocks away from their hospital destination, the two Graham County detention officers transporting Jordan claim that she had somehow, miraculously, managed to escape all of her restraints, which included a pair of handcuffs, a second pair of ankle cuffs, and a belly chain. She was then magically able to open the back door of their patrol car, from the inside, obviously, and then voluntarily leapt from their vehicle while it was traveling at least 35 miles an hour. If you thought Jordan was okay after her miraculous escape from officer's custody and leaping from this car, you would be absolutely kidding yourself. Jordan's body fell hard and fast to the pavement below and was forcibly rolled a couple times by the back wheels of this car. She then lay there in the road, bleeding out, while two clearly incompetent detention officers slowly came to a complete stop down the street. And a whole ass 30 seconds later, the male officer hops out and runs back 20 yards to Jordan's body, just to witness her literally dying in the middle of 20th Avenue. And do you know how I know all this? There's not only body cam footage of this with the officers describing it themselves, but there's also a nearby business security camera recording the entire thing. Best believe the links are also available for your own viewing discretion, and I do warn you, those links are especially graphic. If things weren't bad enough, these officers also explained that they didn't even attempt to do CPR on Jordan, citing the obvious damage to her body already. Never mind the hospital's literally within 2,000 feet of their location. Eventually, additional officers began arriving at the scene, and the two transporting deputies can be seen explaining that Jordan had just jumped out of the car and was then subsequently run over by the rear wheels of their vehicle. Like, you know, what are you going to do? Listen for yourself.
Well, I was to the hospital and stuff, and all of a sudden the door opens. These doors aren't supposed to open on the inside.
He jumped out the back.
Like, are you kidding me? Have you guys ever in your life heard of all those things happening in one case? How many episodes of Cops have you probably watched to know how many fucking stars had to line up for Jordan to have all those restraint systems be faulty and the backseat of the prisoner transport vehicle to be openable from the inside of the car? Like, David Blaine would be losing his freaking mind right now. Even other officers that arrived are absolutely mind blown at how something like this could have occurred.
Documents, because that doesn't make any sense.
Last couple of days, I guess, have gone to hell. There's allegations that Officer French...
That body camera may have been turned off.
Yeah. It's not making sense to me either. Eventually, Jordan's mother, Deborah, gets a phone call in regards to Jordan, but instead of being able to arrange another visitation, Deborah is being told that Jordan had been involved in an accident and was currently being flown from the hospital there in Safford over to Banner University Medical Center in Tucson, Arizona, which is also another 2 hours away from Safford. Can you imagine the absolute panic that Deborah had to suffer through on that two-hour drive? And all to finally get there and find your beautiful daughter practically unrecognizable and lifeless in a hospital bed. Deborah was only then informed that the accident Jordan was in had caused her brain stem to be completely smashed. She was brain dead, and this was in addition to suffering through multiple broken bones in her skull, chest, arm, and legs. Of course, Jordan's family is at a loss for words, like she was in a car accident with the police. No, it's only at this point that their family was told that earlier in the day, Jordan had originally been transported to Sierra Vista for a second medical evaluation, and upon her return to Safford, she managed to escape her restraints, had jumped out of the car, and was subsequently run over by the rear wheels of the department's nearly 5,000-pound Ford Explorer, basically presenting it as an unintentional act of suicide through desperation to escape from officer's custody for a second time. The officers put it all onto Jordan, and now her mom is being faced with the decision to take her daughter off life support as there's really nothing more that can be done to save Jordan. This ended her life. Learning the family would have to say their final goodbyes is absolutely shocking. Jordan's aunt would end up posting to her personal Facebook about Jordan's recent situation, her allegations, her terrible condition, and very bluntly began raising some concerns with the convenience of Jordan's so-called accident. And this post pretty much went viral. It now has over 20,000 shares. Within hours, it's now early morning, December 28th, and Deborah had made the tough decision of allowing her daughter to rest in peace. Jordan's family was told at the very least that some of Jordan's organs would be donated to other patients in need, ultimately making the best of the tragedy that had become them. Jordan was then walked down the hospital floor for the very last time with present friends and family and staff to honor Jordan's passing and her gracious choice to be an organ donor. But now because the cops that dealt with Jordan are trying to tell her mom that Jordan is suicidal and that it was because of her own suicidal actions that led Jordan to her own death, it's just not something her mom, Deborah, can easily accept. Deborah understands how Jordan might look to a lot of people, and especially a bunch of officers, being that she has a history of addiction. But they weren't aware of how far Jordan had recently come in her life. Deborah says her gut won't allow her to buy it. She knows with everything in her that her daughter did not jump from that car. She had 30 days clean and was working so hard. All they want to do is make her look bad, and they have no idea what she really had going on and how far she had come. She understands, too, that Jordan might have been emotionally pushed to the brink given the circumstances, especially if Jordan had yet again been sexually abused, especially by someone like a police officer. But Deborah knows with everything in her that Jordan did not willingly jump from this police car and was not suicidal. Deborah absolutely feels like this was all to shut Jordan up. She says, quote, "I believe she was beat up. And I'm going off of this from what I saw on my daughter's body when I arrived at the hospital. I believe she was pushed out of that vehicle. I honest to God do. I feel like they did a body dump trying to make sure Jordan, because she ratted out a cop, and they were going to make sure that she kept quiet about it. They silenced my daughter. They wanted to make sure she never came forward, and I cannot let them get away with murder. That's how I feel." Deborah points out the complete lack of road rash type injuries you would expect to see on someone who willingly jumped from a car, right? And those scrapes and scratches simply did not exist on Jordan's body. She didn't even have bruising around her wrists where she would have had to like wiggle out of her handcuffs. And honestly, after hearing all the things that happened to Jordan, and with how many other people are undeniably getting abused and killed by police officers, who wouldn't at least question the idea of someone trying to shut Jordan up? I mean, they sure as fuck did a good job if that was the case, right? I'm with Deborah on this one. This is pretty sus, in my opinion. This is absolutely suspicious. Following her final breath, Jordan received an autopsy that was performed by the Pima County Medical Examiner, which the results wouldn't technically be released for another 6 months or so, but that's why podcasts are kind of cool sometimes. But that report would actually reveal that not only was Jordan legit suffering from an undiagnosed issue with her fallopian tubes and some ovarian cysts, but also something called Meckel diverticulum, which is said to be a lifelong medical issue within the intestines. And that tells me that at least the initial pains and worries Jordan was complaining about when she was first arrested, about feeling pregnant or having stomach pains, that was likely not just your average bitching and whining because you have to go to jail. She was having several legitimate health problems that had not yet been diagnosed. It adds credibility to her statements, all of her statements, in my opinion. On top of that, a toxicology report also showed no evidence or presence of either drugs or alcohol in Jordan's system, which also goes to credit that Jordan wasn't under the influence to any degree. Typically, opiates can stay in the bloodstream from anywhere to 4 or more days, depending on the person and their personal use history. If you recall, too, Officer Jeremiah French had noted that Jordan refused all offers for medication. So you think if she was just trying to get medicine, she wouldn't have refused it. On to her autopsy, Jordan's official cause of death was considered to be, quote, blunt impacts to the head, trunk, and extremities, which apparently included 45 total injuries to her skull, clavicle, ribs, spine, and brain. She was also found to have incurred subdural hematomas and multiple contusions, which is when you get the blood swelling in your skull and just horrible bruising. Jordan's technical manner of death, though, was noted to be undetermined. Not suicide, not homicide, not natural death, but undetermined, meaning there isn't enough evidence to definitively say what the manner of death was. Now, this honestly is both frustrating and interesting that the Pima County Medical Examiner deemed her manner of death undetermined. Because not only does that indicate that there isn't enough evidence to prove what the sheriff's department is claiming, which is suicide, but as well as the fact that it can't be proven that this was an intentional act of murder either. However, as far as court or any possible upcoming trial would ever go, it's going to be very, very hard to argue either way, simply because the medical examiner didn't side either way. He left it very open. I so badly wished there would have been an opportunity for a second medical examiner's opinion, but unfortunately, Deborah had been assured that she was safe to have her daughter cremated. Jordan's family would then have to pick out an urn and have Jordan cremated, all while her Christmas presents still sat beneath the Christmas tree. Jordan's family was able to host a vigil for those willing to support their beliefs. However, Jordan's family was actually not allowed to keep a memorial site for Jordan in the area that she had technically died in, there on 20th Avenue, because ironically, the funeral business located there had threatened to throw away any items that local mourners or supporters of the family had started to leave behind in honor of Jordan's life. Like, how freaking heartless for a funeral business, of all places, to be. In the meantime, the Graham County Sheriff's Department will then become publicly adamant that their deputies did nothing wrong concerning Jordan's in-custody death, but that they were absolutely taking Jordan's accusations of sexual assault very seriously, insinuating that they would also be doing an investigation. In regards to Jordan's death specifically, Graham County Sheriff Allred tells the local newspaper, quote, "I wish it hadn't happened, but when somebody is bound and determined to do things, most of the time they find a way to get it done. We will never be able to ask her and find out exactly what it was she was thinking or what she wanted to get done. A lot of people can speculate, including ourselves, but until we find some other type of evidentiary stuff, we won't know." End quote. Really, Sheriff Allred? Real quick, did you do your training in Manitowoc County by chance? Because I'm going to be pointing out a lot of evidentiary type of stuff here in a bit, bet. But because the assault allegations being made online and Jordan's death now making headline news, the state of Arizona Department of Public Safety would also be pressured to begin an internal investigation into Jordan's multiple sexual assault claims and, of course, very convenient subsequent in-custody death. But only 3 months later, in March of 2020, the Department of Public Safety announced that they also found no wrongdoing on the part of any officers alleged to be involved with Jordan Marie Sims, and that there would be absolutely no charges pressed against any officers in her case. Apparently, through hundreds of hours of interviews, recorded conversations between Jordan and her mom, officer reports, and surveillance reviewing, the Arizona Department of Public Services simply cannot find enough evidence to substantiate Jordan's claims of sexual assault, and that it seems Jordan died as the officers had described. I mean, I call bullshit, because listen to this. The internal investigation had revealed that the first rape kit sample results that were taken from Jordan's genital area at Lori's place were confirmed to be that of a male, but they were considered inconclusive because there wasn't enough of the male DNA to test with Officer French's. Now, hold your anger for just a minute, because honestly, it gets so much worse. And personally, the bigger issue I have is, number one, in that scenario, she's locked in a hospital room, in handcuffs, alone, with a male officer. And number two, there is no body cam footage, only specifically for the time that Jordan is claiming to have been sexually assaulted. That should not go against her and mean that there isn't enough evidence to substantiate her claims. That means that there should be some sort of resolution to whether or not that officer should or should not have turned off his body camera. On top of that, how would Jordan ever even know if the body cam was on or off at the time of her assault, which would have ultimately proved what really happened in that hospital room? If she was lying, it would have been easily disproven by the hypothetical body cam footage, but like, oops, there isn't any. Regarding the investigation into Jordan's second assault claims against Officer Kiana Bays, investigators found the female detention officer had previously written in a memo that basically all that happened during their interaction in that shower room was Jordan removed her clothes, she squatted down and coughed, but without being asked to, which is kind of weird to note, but okay. The memo then says that the officer left the shower room temporarily to grab some toilet paper from a hall closet and then returned to the shower room to give it to Jordan. There is nothing noted about any contact of any sort or anything out of the ordinary other than Jordan coughing without being asked. But like, of course, right? Like, why would the officer be like, and then I shoved a pen in her ass? Come on, that wouldn't be in the report. I thought we would never read that. It's not going to say anything about her being guilty ever. The jailhouse surveillance footage, though, was reviewed and showed a handcuffed Jordan being led to the shower room by this female detention officer so that she can change out of her clothes. Both women enter the shower room at 2:58, leaving the view of the camera for about 2.5 minutes. You then see the detention officer come out of the shower at 3 a.m. on the dot. She walks down the hall a few feet, apparently exchanging something from her left shirt pocket to another officer, and then grabs some toilet paper, which she claims Jordan had requested. Within a few seconds, both the detention officer and Jordan are then seen walking out of the shower room to Jordan's padded cell. Jordan was now wearing the green anti-self-harming suit. The footage really isn't good enough to see what item the female officer pulled from her shirt was, but it would most likely seem to be a pen. It doesn't take long to shove a pen in someone's butt. They had a whole 2 minutes together, and that also probably isn't something that would cause very much physical trauma per se, more so psychological and emotional and mental, since this would have been some sort of fucked up power move, honestly. In my opinion, a pen would also probably be small enough to conceal and seem relatively normal to have on your person in this particular area of the jail. However, nothing can be proven because of the lack of video evidence and physical evidence. That does not mean it couldn't have happened, though. And on top of that, there was physical evidence noted of the bruise on Jordan's forehead, per the sexual assault nurse, who saw Jordan before and after this second assault. More credibility. Next, the second rape kit results reveal there was a, quote, low level of male DNA located on the anal swabs taken from Jordan. But because Jordan had reported that it was a female officer as the one to sodomize her, and the previously reported male officer only had contact with her vagina, according to Jordan, the male DNA found in her anal area was then treated as irrelevant, basically. The report says, quote, inconclusive DNA results indicate that insufficient information exists to support any conclusion. So, because there was male DNA, but not enough to form a profile, and unfortunately this other DNA was found in her butt and not her vagina, and since Jordan said the male officer only touched her vagina, the DNA in her butt is just not their problem. Okay then, because she'd only been in jail for the last 4 days, right? She's just got male DNA everywhere, but not enough to support anything? What? Are you kidding me? As far as Jordan's in-custody death goes, investigations cited Jordan had allegedly mentioned several times that she wanted to die while in the presence of several different officers. So they red-tagged her, switched her clothing, gave her an anti-self-harm smock, and stuck her in a padded cell. Officers reported that at one point Jordan had even tried to strangle herself using this issued anti-suicide smock, but obviously that didn't and probably wouldn't ever work. However, even the sexual assault nurse examiner, who spoke with Jordan on two different occasions, one of them being just prior to her alleged suicide, would later explain to investigators that, quote, there wasn't anything in Jordan's behavior or anything that she said that gave me concern that something like this would happen. Which to me, again, sounds like she agrees Jordan did not seem suicidal in the moments before leaving the advocacy center. That coincides with Jordan's mother's beliefs that she willingly didn't leap from that vehicle. On a whole other point, too, wouldn't committing suicide 2 blocks away from a hospital be, like, honestly, the weirdest place to attempt committing suicide? While you're on the way to a hospital? in the backseat of a police car at that. I don't find it as easy to believe as the police are trying to justify here. They also believe Jordan was absolutely desperate to escape custody because she had, one, ran from Officer French, and two, expressed to her mother during recorded phone calls on multiple occasions, pleading for her mother to get her out of jail. So police are making these requests out to be evidence that Jordan so badly wanted to escape jail that she literally jumped from a moving sheriff's car to do so. And no, the real problem is that Jordan's bond was eventually set at $25,000, but it was Christmas. And Jordan's mom didn't even know where she was until Jordan called her from jail 2 days after her arrest. And by that point, Jordan had already been assaulted at least one time. Graham County sheriffs determined that Jordan must have, finger quotes here, must have stolen because, you know, she was supposedly stealing from Walmart in the first place. But for the sake of their argument, Jordan was able to strategically steal some Diamond Resorts brand shower gel during an unsupervised visit to the bathroom during her sexual assault examination at Lori's place, so she could later slip out of her belly chain, ankle cuffs, and handcuffs. They believe she planned on stealing some type of lubricant the entire time. Like, did Jordan just get lucky that the bathroom had some sort of slippery lubricant that could explain her being able to slip from 3 different sets of handcuffs? Like, she had this all planned out before she arrived? Really? I mean, I honestly wonder if there was even evidence of the presence of shower gel on her handcuffs or her body. And it was actually the examiner that requested Jordan be taken to the hospital nearby there in Sierra Vista. However, for whatever reason, the deputies decided to drive back the 2 hours to Graham County instead. So again, did Jordan just get lucky that it was the longer route so she could complete her insane plan to escape the situation she's in? Really? Like, think about it. If in fact this is all one big plan that Jordan had to commit suicide, Jordan would have no way of knowing which hospital the deputies were ever going to take her to, or if all these things were going to happen. The investigation also found that the particular transport vehicle that was being used this day, of all days, was actually a borrowed transport vehicle, and not the regular ride either one of the officers would normally drive, as theirs was said to be in the repair shop for a check engine light. They then conveniently found that the driver's side back of this borrowed transport vehicle was said to have interior backseat door handles, like any old regular car with the child lock options inside the door frame, and not like a regular transport vehicle used for prisoners, apparently. This was a totally different car from what they're getting at. So again, was it just complete incompetence or Jordan's extremely good luck that neither one of these detention officers who are transporting Jordan absolutely and, like, negligently failed to search her before allowing her to re-enter this transport vehicle? Really? Like, they have one job. They have one job. And then the situation, of course, led to the findings that, naturally, the child lock option for the backseat of this vehicle were then found to be in the off position, but only on the side that Jordan happened to be sitting on. I mean, personally, I think Jordan is the unluckiest person I think I might have ever heard of, given the realities of this case. But yet again, if she planned this whole thing out, is she really so lucky that the back door of this police vehicle's child lock mechanism was shockingly found to be in the off position? That too? The female detention officer transporting Jordan told investigators, quote, "She did not know the vehicle had child locks. In all her years, she had never had a police vehicle that had working child locks or had any child locks." And when they asked her if she remembered locking the back door of the patrol car, she replied, "No, I didn't physically do it." So then, yet another amazing coincidence that neither one of these officers double-checked upon putting her in this vehicle that the door was locked? You're saying they don't know how doors work? After all their years on the job, or driving, for that matter? That's completely ridiculous. On top of that, the sheriff's department clarifies that they believe it was actually Jordan who must have been the one who switched the child lock option to off from the inside of the car. at some point prior to her jumping. I mean, come on. That would honestly be impossible. They say it's Jordan who flips the child lock on the police transport vehicle, but like, when? When would someone who's handcuffed and in ankle cuffs and presumably being escorted into the vehicle with upwards of two or three officers standing in plain sight, like how? How would she have ever done that? How would she have flipped the child lock to the off position? I could understand maybe if the officers were just like, yeah, go ahead, get inside by yourself. But being handcuffed and ankle cuffed and all, I really don't think so. And it's not like you can unlock the damn door after it's been shut already, right? It physically doesn't make sense. It's illogical. Like, do you really not know how a fucking door works? Really? And you guys are walking around with guns? Reports also mention at how one point Jordan had manipulatively and strategically requested that the two detention officers who were transporting her loosen her ankle restraints because they had apparently been applied too tight, to which these detention officers kindly obliged to, and they openly admit it. Is that also not some level of responsibility that we can put back on the cops, since that technically would have contributed to Jordan injuring herself while in their custody? No? Okay, hold on, I still have more. The fact that Jordan was able to do all these things, lube herself up with shower gel, slip her handcuffs off, slip off her ankle cuffs, pull off her belly chain, undo her seatbelt, open the back door, all without these officers noticing for an entire 2-hour drive back to town? Like how? That's bullshit. But they do explain, of course, that Jordan was, quote, unusually quiet and had only once requested for the heat to be turned up. Did they never think to turn around and look at her every once in a while? Are they new? Are they rookies? No, they're most definitely not rookies. This is negligence, if nothing else. And to credit the officers' claims, the Diamond Resorts brand bottle of shower gel that was found in the backseat of their car was also found to be the same brand and sizes of shower gel found in the bathrooms at Lori's place. Personally, I would really like to know if either one of those officers had used the bathroom, the same bathroom, there. This bottle of shower gel happened to be found right on the floor panel next to Jordan's neatly placed jail-issued orange slippers, and all three restraint cuffs were left right there on the back seat of the car. Boom. All nice and neat, just like a pretty present for witnesses to later find. Cool. Really cool. Evidence is all right there, boys. But you know what wasn't in that police car? Cameras. Or GPS, apparently. We do not know if that vehicle stopped anywhere between Sierra Vista and Safford. And we do not know if these officers couldn't have beat the shit out of Jordan on the way back home just to push her out 2 blocks before arriving at the hospital. We'll never know that because there is no inside dash cams into this vehicle. Which is a shame. There should be internal cameras of some sort that would have allowed us to watch the incredible effort that Jordan must have gone through to squeeze out of all those restraints without either one of those officers noticing. There just seems to be nothing that could prove or deny any of the weird things about Jordan's case. And conveniently, the lack of footage only ends up favoring the sheriffs every single time. In addition to the investigation happening, the local newspaper was also able to obtain that one security camera angle with actual footage of the moments that Jordan's body left the county's Ford Explorer as it drove by the Sunshine Valley Apartments at 6:42 p.m. that December 26th. I want to note that if you do watch that footage, it is very dark and grainy and very fast moving, so you will probably need to watch it multiple times to see what is actually happening. From personally viewing the footage, Jordan appears to have fallen headfirst, possibly with her back to the pavement, and her legs were said to have been run over by the rear wheels of the vehicle, but that is not evident with the darkness in the film. The impact and subsequent contact with the vehicle then seems to have dragged Jordan's body, forcing it to roll a few times in the direction that the car was headed. In my personal opinion, this does not appear to be like a tuck and roll type of situation from what I viewed. It's almost as if she was literally pushed out of the car with her back to the door and her legs were left in the up position, basically to fall out and drop into the line of contact with the moving wheels of the car. I mean, I watched several YouTube videos of people jumping out of all types of cars and at all types of speeds. And believe me, YouTube has an abundance of amateur jackasses. But one thing is consistent through all the videos. Every single person who jumps from a car stays in motion with the car as they jump. Mainly because they have to, you know, force themselves to jump away from the car. However, when you carefully watch Jordan's video, she clearly did not jump away from this car. Now, if you are to type in videos of falling from a car at 30 miles an hour versus videos of jumping from a car at 30 miles an hour, you will absolutely see the difference in how the objects or persons will land. And when interviewing the two officers who were in charge of transporting Jordan, the female driver of the transport vehicle reported that she immediately called paramedics, who arrived shortly after. But she nor the other male passenger attempted to give Jordan CPR because, quote, they could hear gurgling sounds coming from Jordan. Due to her sustained injuries and the amount of blood present, they did not begin CPR. They didn't want to cause any more trauma or injury to her. Reports did say that Jordan appeared to be breathing, but never actually responsive. And that was all still in the road before paramedics arrived. And after speaking with Deborah, too, she's not even sure really how long her daughter actually laid in that road. It could have been all the way up to 45 minutes, because upon further research, I noticed that every single police body cam in this case is way off sync. But conveniently only after the time in which Jordan left the confines of that advocacy center. You can see from clips released on YouTube that the police body cam at Lori's place reads 12/26/19-23/15, which would equate to December 26, 11/15. But that would actually be impossible because we know Jordan jumped from the vehicle at 6:42 p.m. earlier that same date. One wrong body camera would be one thing, but literally I noticed every cop's body camera is almost 5 hours ahead of time after this point. Something's not adding up, and Jordan's mom Deborah believes with every ounce in her body that Jordan was murdered for speaking out against these officers, and they needed her dead, or basically dead, before entering that hospital. And with the amount of things off in this case, and the things Jordan was claiming before her death, aren't really adding up. Or as the cops view it, you know, the stars just magically aligned perfectly for Jordan and her suicidal/addict mission to very methodically plan escape from police custody. To add credibility again to almost all of Jordan's claims, the Safford, Arizona Area Channel 12 News investigative team actually began independently looking into the alleged misconduct within the jail. And they spoke with an upsetting amount of young women who confirmed that within the Graham County Detention Center, they have quite the history of mixing business with assault. These are a few former female inmates who claim that they had also been propositioned for sex, sexually assaulted, and even raped by officers within this particular jail.
Safford, Arizona, a small town with a population of less than 10,000, home to the Graham County Detention Center.
Speaking now.
A total of 6 current and former inmates going on the record with the 12 News IT.
I'm scared of being raped in that jail.
Telling their experiences, saying there's a culture of abuse by the employees at the Graham County Sheriff's Office and the Safford Police Department.
Girls, doing sexual favors.
For what?
To get out of jail or to have special treatment while they're in jail.
These women now coming forward after the death of Jordan Sims.
Scared of what might happen to them because of our friend that was in here, and, you know, we don't know how far it will go. We don't want to lose our lives.
One inmate showed us explicit messages from a detention officer.
I didn't walk out of this jail for 35 seconds later. I was already receiving
naked pictures of this officer. This county, there's something wrong going on in this county.
If you're not doing something for somebody, you're probably not going to get anything out of this deal.
Very conveniently, too, the exact same day that this news story of additional internal misconduct went live, another officer was then fired from the Grand County Sheriff's Department because everyone else so far named had either resigned, transferred, or were on paid leave. It seems honestly like this particular officer was only fired because of all the clear proof one woman had on her phone and thankfully showed the news before reporting it to the cops. It often seems as though when officers do seem to land themselves in a bit of trouble, I'm learning that a lot of the time, those officers are usually just transferred to another county and begin operating there without much repercussion. And that leaves a lot of room for additional people to be hurt when those breaking the law aren't being held accountable for their actions like everyone else. The very real bigger problem, too, is that what happened to Jordan could easily happen to more women. When this happens, when officers are transferred and no one is held accountable for their actions. One of the local newspapers had even reported that back in 2017, quote, Arizona cops terminated for misconduct at one department often managed to find work at another agency. Between 2000 and 2016, Arizona agencies have hired 418 officers who had been fired or reassigned over misconduct, end quote. And I'd be personally willing to bet a lot of money that this is not just something that happens in Arizona. It's most definitely happening in your state, too. I mean, if you live in the U.S. anyways. And for what? Doesn't it take longer to get a cosmetology license than it does to become a cop? If you'd have to fire 418 officers for misconduct, you think there'd be 418 new job openings for upcoming officers rather than ones who have already shown that they do not respect the oath that they have taken. This is serious shit. As far as Jordan's case goes, by November of 2020, the Arizona Attorney General's office announced they would also not be prosecuting the two officers that Jordan had previously accused of assault because there was not enough evidence, and they believe no criminal charges would be appropriate. Her assault cases and death investigation are basically considered cases closed, which is very frustrating. These cops were still found to have nothing wrong, yet there was male DNA found on Jordan after claiming to have been abused. She died in police custody because they didn't care to double-check the fucking doors. They didn't check their inmate before securing her into the back of the police vehicle. They're completely oblivious to their detainee somehow being able to escape handcuffs, ankle cuffs, and a belly chain in an entire 85-minute drive. The body cam footage is all fucked up, but there's nothing you can hold anyone accountable for? I mean, if these questions can't be answered, then how the fuck can the Attorney General's office reason that there's not enough evidence to hold any of these officers at least negligent, at the very least? Ask yourself seriously, how could all of those things statistically go wrong in just one inmate transport? It's just obscene. The only thing left for Jordan's mom to do, besides maybe taking it up with the federal court somehow, would be filing lawsuits against the county in a wrongful death suit, which Deborah has just begun the process of doing that. Jordan's mom, with the help of two attorneys, will be suing the county and or the sheriff's department for $5 million in the wrongful death of her daughter, Jordan. They fully intend to argue that the county was 100% liable for Jordan's death, pointing out that she died because, quote, she fell out of a police vehicle which should have been secured and locked in place. The sheriffs basically failed to take all the necessary precautions to keep Jordan safe, even from herself. However, I would imagine that funding a legal battle like this one is not very cheap or easy to do when it's literally just her basically fighting for justice. And since speaking out, too, the local law enforcement in Jordan's area has taken unnecessarily to targeting Jordan's mom, being that Safford is a pretty small town. A lot of her local supporters are also afraid of the repercussions that might result from speaking out against their local police, and this is wrong. We cannot keep saying, oh, it's not all cops that are bad, if our hypothetical good ones are also not standing up and speaking out. And it's not just Arizona, it's every single law enforcement entity in America. Something has got to change, and with the clear divide we have right now, I think people are really starting to get sick and tired of the abuse of power there clearly is. While researching for this case, I thankfully had that opportunity to speak with Jordan's older sister, Ashley, and I made sure to ask if there was anything she wanted to say directly to listeners about her sister. And she said, quote, "I just want people to put themselves in our places. My sister had a past, there is no doubt about that. But that doesn't make her any less human than the rest of us. Jordan was battling demons that no one knew about. I just want everyone to know that despite my sister's flaws and addiction, she was the most amazing sister, mother, and aunt to her niece and nephew. Jordan was the most caring, feisty person who never judged anyone and instead helped when others needed help. We now all have to live with this big chunk of our lives missing now because she is gone." At the same time, I also got to speak with Jordan's mother several times and have read or seen literally every single interview that she has publicly given. And I have to say that she is hands down one of the best mothers that I have ever come across. The way she fights for Jordan is the epitome of pure love and loyalty. And in our conversations together, Deborah told me about how Jordan would always make sure her mom, Deborah, had flowers around. Even if it meant grabbing them out of people's yards or bringing her, like, fake silk flowers. It was just a habit of Jordan's that Deborah dearly misses. Now Jordan leaves her mom bird feathers. Even inside her home, Deborah will find bird feathers. She believes this is a sign of Jordan's spirit because her grandfather used to have a nickname for her that meant blackbird. Deborah says, quote, "My daughter did not deserve to die, no matter what. Jordan wasn't perfect. She had issues like most and used drugs for self-medication. But Jordan always loved and had a huge heart. She always wanted to help other people out, and she's never been violent. It was always petty. She always wanted to help other people out." On a more positive note, and in honor of Jordan, ideally, her mom would like to personally honor and give back in her daughter's name by hopefully one day creating a safe place for those in her community who need heartfelt recovery options, and she plans to call it Jordan's Home. Deborah says, "We want that to be a homey place that Jordan always envisioned, and we want to be the ones that help these people get back to where they need to be. Jordan's already changed so many lives, and so many have already gone to rehab and have been living a few months clean or sober because of Jordan. And she just wants to give back to the community in honor of her daughter." Deborah's also started a petition that will help hold the officers related to Jordan's death accountable for their negligence. She needs all the support she can get, and mother to mother, I couldn't hear about this case and simply not offer the opportunity to tell the best supporters that I know. Deborah is doing literally everything she can to get justice for her daughter. She understands it's an uphill battle at this point, but is hoping for some sort of resolution of justice. She's since started the website justiceforjordan.org to raise awareness about her daughter's case, and at the very least, help prevent other women from getting caught up in the clutches of the Graham County Sheriff's Department. Her website is www.justice4jordan, which is spelled J-O-R-D-E-N, not the regular A-N, .org. And on there, she sells t-shirts, stickers, and can koozies to help raise money for her legal battle, including finding someone to retest her daughter's rape kit. And let me tell you, when I learned that Deborah actually hand makes these items, these shirts and koozies, I just about fucking cried, you guys. Please, please, please. I ask that if you want to do anything to support me today, go check out her website, check out her petition. She currently needs about 2,000 more signatures. Please support this amazing mother in any way that you can. Jordan would have been turning the big 3-0, 30 years old, last October 8th, 2021, just a couple weeks back. She had three beautiful children. She had nieces and nephews. She had sisters and a big-ass heart of gold. And nothing Jordan might have done in her life would equate to what has been done to her. And it's literally terrifying that her life might have been taken just to keep her quiet. And to be by those who claim to serve and protect us at that is such a disgrace. Lastly, I have one last major request from my listeners. Please, 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 and I'm not kidding, please ask your other favorite podcasters to cover this case. Please consider signing Deborah's petition or supporting her personal fight by purchasing a Justice for Jordan shirt or a sticker or even donating to her cause. At the very least, I ask that you share this episode with someone, anyone, so the story can get out there. I absolutely know the true crime community can be an unbelievably helpful resource when we work together. The Gabby Petito case is a prime example of that. And I implore all other true crime podcasters listening, big or small, to also look into Jordan's story and research it for yourself. You're absolutely welcome to use all the sources I have in this episode description. I've also maintained a playlist on YouTube with everything I could find related to this case, if you'd like to check those out. I quickly need to shout out this episode's supporters of the podcast, Kendra, Kat, Kaylee, and Sarah E., for all joining the Patreon. And I got a pretty big influx of YouTube subscribers lately, too. So hello and welcome, you guys. Thanks for giving my podcast a chance. Quickly, I want to thank Gina Ray Martinez, Lexi Street, MBL Sides, and DPA Storm for all leaving 5-star reviews. You guys, I really appreciate you guys taking the time out of your day to do those reviews. I want to thank you for making it through the episode today. Jordan deserves justice, and I hope that I can help in any way possible by telling you this story today. Until next time, my loves, as always, remember to be safe and lock those damn doors. All right, you guys. Bye. And that was the tea. I hope you guys enjoyed my rendition of the story, and if so, please tell all your creepy friends about it. You can find the sources I used for the episode in its description, and if you'd like to support the podcast, check out patreon.com/gingerthetruecrimequeen, where I keep all the extra bonus goodies.